If you like an instrument that sings, play the saxophone. At its best, it's like the human voice. The words of jazz musician Stan Getz. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What did Adolf Sax have in mind when he invented the saxophone in the 19th century? What kind of sounds can this instrument produce that make it unique? Does it belong in classical orchestras or just in jazz bands? Joining us to explore the world of the saxophone is Les Thimmig, professor of music, composer, and saxophonist in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Music.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Looking forward to some nice, I want to say, correct me if I'm wrong, sultry and smoky playing, and then some maybe more standard orchestral sounds, too. What was in Adolf Sax's mind when he invented this instrument? What was missing?
Missing? Oh, missing in his mind. We could talk about that. Yeah.
That he felt he had to create an instrument.
Well, it wasn't his idea. You know, the instrument's history is interesting because it is so much unlike that of any other instrument. For example, if our subject today was the flute, and we say, who invented the flute? And you say, oh, Lord. I mean, you know, you get the impression that the flute was just there to start with, and the first human being on the earth walked up and picked it up on the ground and started playing it. You can't put your finger on it. But this is an instrument that had a very definite beginning. I mean, it's like saying that, you know, Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine. We have somebody's name and we have a date and everything. What happened was in the early 1840s, we have to remember how wars were fought in the old days, not like the new days. They were very formal affairs. The two armies lined up facing each other, and on a signal, they marched toward each other, shooting. It's just amazing. And who was out in front? The musicians were out in front of everyone playing patriotic fare to lead the boys on and into stout-hearted battle. It's just amazing to think about now. And there was like an honor system. It was like, you know, a truck with a Red Cross on the roof doesn't get bombed in a war. Well, that was it. Don't kill the musicians. They're unarmed. All they have is a bass drum beater or a trombone. And so the French military had the desire to have a member of the woodwind family that would have the carrying power of a brass for outdoor work.
You need to be able to hear it. That's
the
main thing.
Because, you know, I'm sitting here with an oboist, and we don't use oboes and bassoons in the marching band. You know,
the reed gets in the way. Yep.
Yeah, it's just not the kind of a sound that carries outdoors and so on. So they went to a Belgian instrument maker that, even though he was still a young man, was very well respected, a brass maker, actually, more than anything else. And it was, you've already mentioned the name, Adolf Sax. And so he literally made a woodwind instrument out of the same brass alloy that the trumpet and trombone players use. And so that was all in the 1840s. You'll see differing dates happen. The request from the military came out 1841. He actually did the work 43 and so on, but most often you'll see the date 1846. I think that's because that was the legal date that the patent was secured. That the thing really was, he really delivered the goods to the army. He was quite a guy. We're finding out more facts about him all the time. It may be interesting that about 10 years ago, a wise guy within the saxophone community put together a little list of facts I would like to read into the record this time.
This is about Adolf Sax?
You wait and find out. When he was 2 years old, he fell out of a second-story window and fractured his skull. When he was 6 years old, he mistakenly drank boric acid. When he was 9 years old, he fell over a small cliff and broke his leg. When he was 11 years old, he contracted measles and was in a coma for 9 days. When he was 14 years old, he broke his arm when he caught it in a carriage door. When he was 19 years old, he was struck on the head by a falling brick. When he was 23 years old, he almost died from the effects of tainted wine. When he was 29 years old, Adolf Sax invented the saxophone. So that's our context. It started out that way, and in many respects, it stayed that way ever since.
Was it used for a military instrument then?
Yes, that was its use, and it was very effective because it literally is a woodwind. You know, the fingering system is virtually 90, let's say it's 90% the same as you'd find on an oboe or a flute and so on. And it is made out of the same brass alloy we get trumpets and trombones. So that was the 1840s. The first instruments he made, we would recognize today as being an alto that was in the key of F and a tenor that was in the key of C. And he envisioned, he kind of liked this instrument the more he worked on it. He actually took the job just to make the money. I mean, it wasn't a turn on at first, but he got very interested in it. And he envisioned an entire family of instruments, which of course developed, but he envisioned a set that alternated the keys of C and F for orchestral use, and a set that alternated B-flat and E-flat for military band use. I mean, he immediately saw that this is an instrument that everybody's going to want. And to his shock and everything, the orchestra world didn't take him up on the offer. And, of course, that's the way it is today. We have a family that alternates B-flat and E-flat. They've always been accepted in the various military bands. But we could argue very persuasively that even though you can find the saxophone in an orchestra, we're going to hear a little bit sometime in this show, we could say that the saxophone has never joined the orchestra. Because at about the time the saxophone would have come in, if you study the history of the orchestra, the door shut at a certain point at the end of the 19th century. Nothing new. It was getting bigger and bigger all the time. At a certain point, the tuba, for example, came in. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, the door shut. And nothing new was added.
Thank goodness for jazz, though, came along just about the right time, didn't it,
for the saxophone. And a lot of things, right.
Do you think the fact that the saxophone is so new compared to a lot of other instruments is why it kind of has a reputation as not belonging in the classical orchestra? In other words, some of the other instruments we've done, for example, when we did a program on the harp, you can find passages in the Bible referring to harp. Well, you don't find a saxophone in the Bible. And it doesn't have that, you know, it doesn't have that grounding in history. And do you think that's been behind a sort of typecasting?
That always enters into it. It's the new kid on the block. I mean, the rules of the game have been established. You know, we dress in black in this band, and you're wearing green. Categorically, you must sound bad. You know, it's human nature. It's a version of the ugly duckling story.
But there were some respectable composers who wrote band music in the 19th century.
Sure.
Did they pick it up fairly quickly, the saxophone?
Off and on. Ironically, it was the Germans that were the first ones who... It's been in there with the Germans regularly. To a lesser degree, the French and the British. Very famous name, French classical saxophonist, probably the first great superstar classical player, Marcel Mule. That last name, M-U-L-E, just like the animal, who was a member of the famous Guard Republican Band of France, which is France's equivalent of our U.S. Marine Band, kind of the number one military outfit. And he claims that he invented the saxophone quartet with he and other members of the band in 1926. But we've recently uncovered an old program. In fact, it was a doctoral student of mine who was doing research in American saxophone things. We have a program of the United States Marine Band Saxophone Quartet when a certain Mr. Souza, who we all heard of, was running things. And it's a very interesting thing because this program is dated 1887. And the saxophone quartet consisted of six people. The four people played the saxophone, right? Two altos, a tenor, and a baritone. And then there was a harpist. And we all know that in that day that there were no women in the military. That would be many years before that happened. So very interesting, the sixth person in the quartet was a soprano voice.
And saxophones, harp and soprano.
Is that
a combination you wouldn't expect.
Because to give it that biblical background or something?
They didn't all play at the same time. Don't forget the history of concerts. When Franz Liszt played a piano recital, he always had a singer. And he'd have somebody else play the piano once in a while.
It's part of the package.
So we had a saxophone quartet. We had voice and harp. We had maybe one saxophone and harp. Harp solo. That's how an interesting program was made. It's like a variety show. Yeah. Our modern-day concerts tend to be, if it's your oboe recital, you play the oboe all night long. That's that. See? But even if you're the star of the show, you'd take a break in the middle and give it to someone else.
That's true. You've got now the highest pitched saxophone, though, is a straight bore, whereas you get some of the lower range instruments, and then you get that characteristic bend.
When people think of the saxophone, they're usually thinking of the alto, which is shaped like Sherlock Holmes' pipe.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, that's the best way to think of it. It's like Sherlock Holmes' pipe, and you just keep putting more curves. Get down to the baritone saxophone, you got a complete circle up at the top because you have to, the tube has to be a certain length, and you have to be able to reach it when you play it. You mentioned straight. Most of the time you see the soprano saxophone, it's a straight instrument, about the same length as a clarinet. We call it the concrete clarinet. But my soprano, as you can see here, is curved. It looks like an alto that you left out in the rain. It's just a miniature alto. And it's, again, acoustics are a big deal. The acoustical end of physics is very, very complicated. It's quite interesting and revealing that we live in a time where we put people on the moon and we've done all these accomplishments. Still, the majority of instrument making is done empirically. It's not done scientifically.
Without a formula, it's done...
It's done because that's what works. Uh-huh. You know?
Without exactly
explaining
it?
In other words, we have a great flute maker in America, Vern Powell. People just love their Powell flutes. He knew where to put the holes. Ask him why, he couldn't tell you.
Just sounds.
And we're still, to a great degree, behaving empirically because the whole idea of... It's the kind of physics that goes into air turbulence, the kind of things they mess with airplanes and so on. I started to study it at one point. I thought I was going to be Mr. Smart Guy and learn all about this. I think somewhere about page 17, I closed the book and gazed off into space, and that was, I mean, it is so complex. Then I mentioned this to some physicists and said, oh, you don't want to get there. So it's a tough one. But the one thing we know empirically is that a curved pipe, and of course, to mention what a lot of people may not think of is the range an instrument plays in has to do with how long the tube is. If the tube is longer, you play lower. If it's shorter, you play higher. Think about the piccolo. Think about the tuba. And of course, when the tube gets to be so long, we have to curve it or it wouldn't be playable. We wouldn't be able to reach it with our hands. But what we know is that a curved pipe in relationship to the same dimensions in a straight pipe behaves as though it's shorter and fatter. Shorter means plays a little higher, so you got the tuning would be a little bit higher and have to be adjusted. And fatter, bigger bore, which means lower partials more reinforced, the potential for a more complex sound. This is what I like in an instrument, by the way. If I have love in my voice right now, I love big bore. See? So that's why I'm anticipating the question, why do you play a curved soprano as opposed to the straight one that 99 out of 100 people play today? And that's why, because it's just the nature of that curved pipe suits my aesthetics a little more.
Maybe you could demonstrate a few things that you can do on that. But when you were playing and you're sliding, doing the glissandos or whatever, it sounds as if it's much easier for you to do that on the sax than it would be on, say, a oboe or clarinet, as if you can move between the pitches more.
Oboe I can't talk about. Yeah. Clarinet's very easy to do, too. You know, I think everyone has heard the opening clarinet solo and George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
I was just thinking of that.
Sure,
it'd be just comparable playing it on a sax.
So demonstrate some things that show why you love that instrument. What is it that it can do?
Well, why do I love the instrument? First, it's the sound itself. As I said before, it's a very complex sound, and it is a brass instrument. You know, I have to tell a story. I have this friend who's a trumpet player. We don't live in the same city, but we play together X number of times a year and something or other. Known each other a long time. And we played something, and as musicians like to do, we went to the bar afterwards and had a beer. And as he was, hey, you sounded good tonight. Oh, thanks, man, you too. And and all of a sudden, I wasn't looking at him at the moment, and he said, you know what I like about you, Thimig? You are the only saxophone player I ever play with who understands that it's a brass instrument, not a woodwind. And I thought this was the opening line to some sarcasm, so I turn around to laugh. And he is sitting there, face like a judge. I mean, poker face. He was deadly serious. And then we had a conversation on the subject, and I understood what he meant. And I wound up coming away thinking that was one of the nicest compliments I ever had, that I don't sound like a woodwind player. But that's it. There's a thickness and a kind of a bottom in the sound. Or, it just occurred to me, borrow a little slang term brass guys like to use and woodwind players don't. The sound has a lot of belly in it.
Right.
There's belly in the sound that isn't typical of the woodwind family, see? So that appeals to me. And also the kind of flexibility. I can sit in a brass section and play as loud as the brass, right? I can also play a note so soft that in the recording studio, a $2,000 microphone doesn't pick it up when I'm sitting a foot away. So I would even, at the risk of sounding like a saxophone chauvinist here, I would bet my shiny quarter that the saxophone has the largest effective dynamic range of any instrument, certainly in the woodwinds.
So closest approximation to the human voice in that sense.
Well, in a sense, yeah. We open with the great Stan Getz quote, and of course variants on that statement have been made many times. Actually, all the instrumentalists will tell you that their instrument sounds the most like the human voice. But that's a model we have of wanting to sound like the voice. It's in a very real sense, these instruments are a replacement of the voice. We're not singers, so we use this device to do our singing anyway. And I've always heard that because of the vocal quality, in other words, in the jazz world, another little slang term is talking about a vocal approach. See? So let me demonstrate.
Contrasting
okay,
two
now
styles.
The two. I played the opening phrase of Duke Ellington's famous ballad in a sentimental mood. First way, I played it, as we like to say, straight.
Straight.
Yeah. In other words, the way I might play it if I were sitting in a symphony orchestra clarinet section or something. You know? Hopefully that sounded perfectly nice and so on, and it was good. But the second way, I did it the way I might sing it.
Yes.
Or even better than that, the way we talk, you know. All music has a very strong basis in the conversational speech of the people making the music. See? So the idea of American English is very important for our music. You know, if we look at popular music going back in the 20s, think back, I wonder if the name Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald mean much to anybody anymore, but they were very famous singers, you know, and they sang their songs. It was very much like German operetta in English. Only make believe you love me. It was that way. And somewhere around 1930, a change took place that singing, all of a sudden, rather than singing in the high head tones, people dropped down here where we actually talk rather than up here where we sing. You know? And all of a sudden, the square corners came off the rhythms and they started going. And you know who started this? And I only knew about this when the guy died, and I read a very lengthy, marvelous musical obituary on him by the fine writer Nat Hentoff. Crosby.
I was going to say,
Bing Crosby. I mean, you know, to me, the guy who in the movies with Grace Kelly, but I mean, he's still like, blah, 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 all that stuff. It was first the performing, then the composing started going along American English speech rhythms. Then by the get into the 1930s, Cole Porter, Night and Day, You Are the One. Only you beneath the stars and under the sun. That's the way you'd say it, see, and he had everybody sing it. So with that in mind, that the music follows the contour of the voice, listen to my voice as I'm talking right now. I don't sound like I'm trying to affect anything, but you see, I am kind of sliding around and slithering up and up and down. And up. We don't talk like this all the time unless we are making a joke, see. And so when you take those square corners off, then that natural linguistic flow comes in. So that's a very important consideration whenever considering American music. And, of course, my little beautiful saxophone here just lends itself to that, all that slipping and sliding, we used to call it, right?
Well, so much was happening, you know, in just a few years there in the 30s. I mean, you do have Bing and Russ Colombo and people like that coming in. But is it coincidental that 1935 you have Benny Goodman and the Birth of Swing? Is that all part of that same kind of speech pattern change?
Oh, sure, yeah. It was even before 35. You know, even back in 32 and 33, things were already happening, you know. And because, you know, the Ellington tune titled It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got There, that's 1930.
Is it that early?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. And so that phenomenon left over from the, you know, the many changes took place. Look at the 20s for the changes. That's where everything was set in motion. Yeah, with, you know, even the Charleston. And so on, and all the attitudes toward it. All of a sudden, Americans were feeling pretty good about being American about things.
The instrumentation certainly changed in the 20s. If you listen, well, I mean,
that's where the jazz orchestra developed, where instead of single instruments like we used to have in the old band, one clarinet, one trumpet, one trombone, now we're developing sections of them, which is simply a way to play louder. Instead of one trumpet playing, we will have three trumpets playing the full chord, which will make more noise and fill up a larger ballroom for the swing dancing.
Sell more tickets.
So really, I call it, you know, rather than the trumpet section, I call it the pregnant trumpet. It just takes that single instrument concept and blows it up. Yeah. See, so now we have three trumpets and three trombones and four saxophones and so on. That's where the orchestra came from.
And we're going to sample some more music from the saxophone when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Les Thimmig, and we're talking about the saxophone. When I would play in the orchestra, symphony orchestra, every once in a while, they'd go and find a saxophonist for a particular piece, but not usually. Can you say something about the role that the saxophone plays or does not play in the classical orchestra?
Well, as we said before, the instrument was set in motion in the 1840s and was adapted by the military bands right away, so it wasn't as though it was hidden in a closet. It was out there. Had the orchestras wanted it, they could have had it. Obviously, they didn't want it, and the composers didn't want to write for it. And, I mean, the history of the saxophone joining different performing media is so often a matter of the kicking and screaming image that we're familiar with. So it was really until the late 19th century that the saxophone was brought in strictly as an outside soloist. You know, I liken it very often to Mahler symphonies are very popular these days, and the mandolin. Several Mahler orchestral works use a mandolin, you know. And so does that mean the mandolin has joined the orchestra? It does not. And very often orchestras have trouble finding a player. I mean, some of the mandolin, they're folk players, and they don't like to read music very much. So here you have an hour and a half symphony you have to read. But the mandolin was there to have a certain expressive purpose, to bring out a certain kind of a folk element, the country and so on. Whenever Mahler wrote for the little C soprano clarinet, he was trying to make it sound like a country tavern band in Austria and so on. So it was this kind of a special expressive purpose.
A one-time only gig.
Yeah, not to be. See, the real test is, I mean, anything can be a soloist once in a while. I just saw that a 24-CD set of the music of Ennio Morricone, the great Italian film composer, has just come out. And, of course, with him, anything can play the melody. You know, the harmonica, the jew's harp, you name it. But the real test is, has the instrument joined the ensemble? Is it a rank-and-file member of the ensemble? Anybody can be a soloist once, but are you a member of the ensemble? Are you sitting there as just one of the worker drones in the midst of the harmony, the way the second clarinet player is or the third trumpet player?
Well,
and the answer is usually, with the saxophone, no.
You get this connection right around, well, late 19th, early 20th century, where jazz starts to arrive on the American scene. And the French get interested in it. Was it really the French who brought it in, the saxophone, into the orchestra? Was it through that jazz influence that it all came about?
I think the saxophone had been used in the orchestra before. The French are very big at that. The French liked the saxophone. A little kind of a sweet quality the old-time players had. Went right hand-in-hand with the French woodwind concept of the last part of the 19th century, early 20th. I mean, the French kind of ruled the roost woodwind-wise, 1890, 1900 and so on, and the saxophone was it was an item. It was you know, talked about then. How do you feel about the saxophone? It was a controversial issue, you know. And Europe didn't know a thing about jazz until 1918, when Noble Sissle and some other New Orleans orchestras, including a very young Sidney Bechet playing both clarinet and soprano saxophone, visited Europe. And there's a famous letter from the noted conductor Ernst Ansermé, the Swiss conductor.
Sure.
He wrote a letter that's been reproduced a lot, extolling the virtues of this new American music. He said, and one day all of Europe will be tapping its toe to this music, and the composers will be, which of course has happened.
Yes.
You know, he hit the button right in the head. So the 1920s is what really unleashed everything. World War I is over with, 1918, all of a sudden the flow of humanity across the ocean is resumed again.
And, Europe becomes Americanized.
Yeah, and of course Europe once again became very important for Americans, you know, the writers, Hemingway and so on. So it's hard to put your finger on an exact beginning, but it was around there someplace.
And with back to the orchestra question, what would be a time when you would be called in to a symphony orchestra, not as a rank-and-file drone, but as a sort of a special effects, special moment person?
Well, it's something we're going to listen to in just a minute. A very, very well-known orchestral work is Maurice Ravel's orchestration of Mussorgsky's piano piece, The Pictures at an Exhibition, which is ironically more famous now as Ravel's orchestration. Some people don't even know it's supposed to be a piano piece. One movement very early in the piece, it's titled The Old Castle in English, and its melody, this beautiful minor key melody, is played by a saxophone, alto saxophone, by the way. The alto is by far the most prominent classical music voice in the saxophone world. You know, like we say the clarinet, just the word clarinet, it should be soprano clarinet. But it's so dominant that we just say clarinet and that's good enough. You know? People do the same thing with saxophone. Well, it's the alto saxophone. And it's very beautiful. That's why I chose it to play today. It's just an ideal use. Ravel heard the saxophone so beautifully. And it's a lovely movement and the saxophone is just right for it and that's that. There's supposed to be a separate saxophone player because it can't be a clarinet doubling part because there's already three parts for the clarinet section to play. See, I know this. I've played it. I've only once in my life have I played it and just sat there and been the saxophone player. Usually, as the bass clarinet player, you just pick up your saxophone, but that leaves the bass clarinet. You're supposed to go boom, 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 background. There's a way to rewrite that and give it to the bassoon. So anyway, it's a separate part, and the piece goes on, and you get to the end, of course, the Great Gate of Kiev, which uses everyone in the orchestra. It's the first tutti in the piece. I use this piece in orchestration class, and you don't know it, but you're never hearing the full orchestra throughout that piece until you get to the Great Gate, which means then it sounds like, you know, the earth is opening up. And in fact, you only learn then that there's a second harpist that's brought in just for the Great Gate, harp one and two. I mean, everybody and his mother is in this last movement. But where's the saxophone?
Back there at the old castle.
There's no saxophone.
Oh, how sad.
Yeah. People say, why is that? And I said, you know what? I think it's no more or no less than an oversight on Ravel's part. By the time he got there, he'd forgotten.
Could he have thought it just was going to be too loud and prominent?
No, I don't think so. Not with what's going on in that that movement. Are you
kidding? Right. It's plenty loud.
The literal meaning of the word supernumerary. It's like you're sitting up on top, but you're not in. We have some great examples of use of the saxophone in the orchestra as an ensemble voice, which shows what the potential could have been had it been allowed in. And for that, I highly recommend Mr. Prokofiev. Two of his more famous pieces, one is Lieutenant Kije. And the other, Romeo and Juliet. They both use the tenor saxophone. The saxophone has a chameleonic-like quality. It can blend in with its environment, much the way a French horn does in the orchestra. And in these two pieces, you can hear the tenor saxophone being used almost as a kind of liaison officer between the brass and the woodwinds. You know, you're listening and you think you're hearing the bassoons, and all of a sudden there's that thing that's it's kind of like a bassoon, but what? Oh, that's the saxophone taking over from the bassoon, and delivery to the horns, and it blends in with the horns, and pretty soon you're in the brass section. This goes on all the time, but it shows how useful the instrument could be if utilized, but it's just been so rarely utilized that way.
What other composer featured the saxophone?
Well, as we got further into the 20th century, many people did. Certainly in France, it became established. France was probably the first country to have saxophone solo recitalists. And I mentioned before the name of Marcel Mule. And there was also the Dane Sigurd Rascher. They were the two big ones in Europe.
Very much recorded.
Yeah. Yeah, but if we want to take a head count, there's more Frenchmen than anyone else doing it. And so French composers began turning out music. And, of course, we have the institution known as the Prize at the Paris Conservatory, which is awarded every year, and for which a new piece was always written. So there's a whole generation of French composers that literally paid their rent and clothed and fed their kids by getting the commission to write this end-of-the-year prize piece every year. So this year it's a flute piece, next year you do the harp piece, and the year after that you do the trumpet piece, and the other guy does the harp. And it was an arrangement that we've known nothing like that in the United States. And one of these composers was Eugene Boza. And so we have an example now of Boza writing for the quartet that Mule thought he formed for the first time in the 1920s. This piece is approximately 1940, and we'll hear the Andante movement of the Andante and Scherzo for saxophone quartet, where we hear good examples of both individually and in ensemble of the soprano, alto, tenor, and baritone, the four principal voices in the saxophone family.
Thank you.
That's really a beautiful blend and so lyrical.
Yeah.
That was the
Hollywood Saxophone Quartet recorded in the 50s, and we have yet to surpass those guys. Those were the people who were recording the movie scores. You've heard all those guys play. You've actually heard them also play clarinets and oboes as well. That alto saxophone, as you just heard. You know, in the noir films from the late 40s and the 50s, Humphrey Bogart's walking down a dark street with his trench coat collar up and that swooping alto saxophone. You know, he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. You just listen to him. His name's Jack Dumont.
There's not a lot of saxophone quartet music, though, is there?
Oh, it's tons.
Is there?
Yeah.
Glazunov wrote a piece.
Oh, it's an uncountable number, and they're little quartets. They stick at home all the time. The outside public doesn't hear about them.
But it is. It's a very sweet sound.
Yeah,
it's mellifluous.
Very nice. There's a property in the saxophone sound. The person who's the professor at the main conservatory in Brussels, and I have to apologize, I've forgotten the proper name of the school. The main conservatory of Brussels, we'll call it. In an interview, he said he was extolling the virtues of his instrument, as most people do. And he said, you know, the quality of this voice, this saxophone voice, it just floats in the air. He said, each day when I finish my teaching, I walk 10 blocks to catch my train. And in the warm weather, all the students practicing, the windows are open in the conservatory. And he said, and as I walk away from the building, one by one, all the instruments drop out. Pretty soon, I can't hear the strings anymore. And then all of a sudden, there's no more flute, and then we lose the bassoons. And he said, but I get down to my train, I can still hear the saxophone players practicing. That sound just floats on the air. And that really is true. I've had that same experience myself, even with people playing outdoors behind our student union, which for those of you who are not UW-inclined, is a couple of big blocks away from where we're sitting right now in the Communication Arts Building. You could stand on the street here and still hear the high saxophone.
Well, that's kind of what sax had in mind in the first place, isn't it?
It worked. Yeah. We're going to talk about the sax in jazz when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
We want to know what you think. Your comments are important to us, and the audience services staff is ready to assist you. Get in touch with us anytime by visiting us at wpr.org. Click on Listener Feedback.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Les Thimmig, and we're talking about the saxophone. What a phenomenon. 100 years ago or so, Claude Debussy was sort of hauled kicking and screaming into the world of saxophone writing by a commission from a wealthy amateur by the name of Mrs. Elise Hall. Is his story pretty typical?
Yeah, he hated the instrument. if you study about Debussy at the end, you wind up crying. The poor guy was dying of rectal cancer, and he had no money, and so he had to do anything. And then this nut job, rich lady in Boston, who just thought the saxophone was the wave of the future, was asking people to write pieces for her, right? And she gave, $1,000, I don't know what it was, old-time money. And he had to say it because he would do anything for money. And he just hated it. And he wrote one of his worst pieces, too. You know, at that same period,
was
his clarinet rhapsody, which is one of his greatest pieces.
Yeah, sure.
And then the saxophone rhapsody is totally disposable as far as I'm concerned. And I'm a major league Debussy fan, by the way.
This amateur, this Mrs. Hall, she was part of a wave of amateur interest
in
the saxophone?
Very interesting. Starting for a convenient round number, let's go to 1900. From about 1900 through the 20s, this is kind of hard to believe today, but the saxophone was the major amateur instrument in America, with the possible exception of the piano, much as the guitar is today. I mean, think about the guitar. I sometimes ask the students, I said, we have a major dormitory right across the street from our music building. I said, over in Chadburn Hall there, how many guitars are there per floor? And of course we don't know, but you know it's going to be some number because everybody has one and they like to play it. The saxophone was the same way. And the size of the family at one time included 13 different members. The mezzo-soprano saxophone in F. And they made a tenor in C and a soprano in C so you could read popular sheet music at the piano and not have to transpose.
Uh-huh.
Why do you think it was so popular then?
People just liked it. It was something fun to do. The word went out that it's easy to play a saxophone.
I've heard that even very recently.
Hard to play a clarinet, easy to play a saxophone.
Is that true?
No. I'll say this, though. That's a legitimate question. And the answer is all these instruments, if you're going to really play them, are hard to play. But I'll say this. Let's pretend we could clone five people, all right? And these five identical people are all going to become beginners. One on flute, one on oboe, one on clarinet, one on bassoon, one on saxophone. Let's check in with them at the end of 3 weeks. The saxophone player is going to be doing a little bit better. There's an immediacy to getting at the saxophone. Certainly on the oboe, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. 3 years later, you're still, the learning curves are different. But at the end of 6 months, they're all going to be the same. Yeah, so it's a fallacy. There's a little tiny grain of truth in there, but it ultimately becomes a fallacy. So the manufacture of saxophones was just through the roof. It was unbelievable. Then we hit 1930, again, a round number. Where did they go? It was like the Mayan population, Nobody knows where they went. Mm-hmm. There was no pestilence. There was no enemy fighting a war with them. They just left. They left empty buildings behind and disappeared. Where did the saxophones go? By the time we get past 1930, the family is reduced to three voices, alto, tenor, and baritone. Soprano and bass are now obsolete instruments. They are not being manufactured at all. And they wouldn't be again until 1954, when the Selmer Company of France brought out its quite innovational line of saxophones known as the Mark VI. They reintroduced the soprano, reintroduced the bass. But all that time, that was it. And the saxophone took its place as a member of things. And if it wasn't for the dance band and the swing band saxophone section, you could almost argue the saxophone might have disappeared. The Broadway Theater pit was another one, too. Thank you, Jerome Kern. 1914, Kern spent the summer in Europe, and he went to some musicals in Germany and really loved the orchestration. And as you do, when you like something in the pit, at intermission, you walk down and peek over the edge, right? And there's two people sitting with saxophones, an alto and a tenor. So he came back. Whatever show he was working on at that time, he instructed his orchestrator. He said, include two saxophones. I like that sound. And that is what established the saxophone in the pit orchestra. Because whatever Kern did, everybody wanted to do in those days.
Where does jazz fit into the sax story then? Because I always think of saxophone and jazz. Yeah,
sure, of course. And it wasn't an original instrument, though. The original jazz band, it was a clarinet, not a saxophone. And having met many of the old-timers who were playing in the 30s, it's interesting to find out that they moved over to the saxophone, to use the phrase again, kicking and screaming. They thought of themselves as clarinet players. But as the orchestras got bigger, needing to fill up bigger and bigger ballrooms with dancers, you got a million people dancing and laughing and drinking. It's a lot of noise, and there's no microphones in those days. You had to make real acoustic music, so the orchestra had to get bigger, just as the symphony orchestra got bigger throughout the 19th century. And it just worked out that a section of three clarinets just didn't hold its own with the brass the way the saxophones did. So the band leaders insisted that you play the saxophone. Most of the players didn't want to. That's an interesting and surprising fact, because the saxophone became so popular and so prominent. Of course, nowadays, what clarinet? Never heard of it. In other words, in jazz, the clarinet just went right out the window.
There were some, but nothing like the sax.
But the saxophone, it reigns, and you can make a persuasive argument that it's the primary instrument today in the jazz world.
I would say, for sure. You mentioned Sidney Bechet earlier. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other early practitioners who really helped the sax to catch on?
Well, what one person got and deserved the title, the father of the tenor saxophone, that's my great hero, Coleman Hawkins, because he was the first one. He made the first tenor saxophone jazz record ever. 1922, I believe it was. He was playing with the Blues Stompers, and that was the first recorded tenor saxophone. So all of a sudden, people were taking it seriously, and by the end of the 20s, the saxophone was there. And it was only in the 30s that we had people who just played the saxophone. It wasn't that other instrument besides the clarinet or the flute or the oboe.
Is there a sample you could play that shows the...
Well, yeah, I had examples of the saxophone solo and then saxophone in ensemble from the classical music world, the orchestral world. We can do the same pair of things from the jazz world. I think one of the most distinctive jazz soloists ever, irrespective of instrument, is the alto saxophonist Johnny Hodges, who was associated with the Duke Ellington Orchestra for 47 years and for 47 years, Duke Ellington, one of the composers most respected in America, wrote saxophone solos for Johnny Hodges, which makes him the most written for saxophone player in history. And so we have a recording from the 50s of Johnny Hodges playing one of his signature ballads of Ellington's, I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good. And we can follow that with a recording from also of the same period in the 50s, done by tenor saxophonist Al Cohn. The name of the album is The Saxophone Section, and this is the standard five-member section, two altos, two tenors, and a baritone. And it shows how styles evolve as well, because the two altos, the person playing lead alto, you'll hear the dominant voice in the ensemble, is Sam Merowitz, a veteran of the swing period, great player, and playing second alto, and also the person who will be playing the alto saxophone solo a little later into the tune, is Gene Quill, a young member of the bebop generation. The tenor saxophone solo was by Al Cohn, who wrote the arrangement. And that'll show you the same kind of solo and ensemble relations going on as were in the classical sections. thought it might be nice to close on a lighter note, that we've made reference to the fact that the saxophone was sometimes not taken very seriously and, of course, has been the butt of quite a few jokes in various periods, one of my favorites being that of one of our great American humorists, W.C. Fields, who offered the definition of a gentleman as someone who knows how to play a saxophone but refrains from doing so.
Well, I'm glad that you have not refrained either from playing it or telling us about how to play it. Thanks for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and thanks for joining us for this hour. Hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.